In 1930, Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto. Since then, it's captured the imagination of astronomy fans around the world, and has even been the subject of great controversy as new guidelines were put in place on what we can technically call a planet. All that aside, humanity has never been able to study the planet up close due to the vast distance from Earth. That changed in 2015 when the New Horizons spacecraft, after traveling for nearly a decade, finally reached this distant celestial object. Richmond, Virginia native Alice Bowman is one of the hardworking scientists that made this mission possible. With that said, it's an extreme pleasure and honor to be chatting with Alice Bowman. Hello, Alice. How are you?
Hi, Prabir. I'm great. I'm happy to be here.
Welcome to Richmond.
Thank you.
Welcome to the center of the universe, as I call it.
That's right. Back home.
Back home. Yeah, you're from here.
I am. I'm from Richmond. I grew up here. I was born here. I went to high school here.
Wow. You were born here. And then at some point, you decided to leave Richmond to explore other places, not necessarily on Earth, right? You kind of...
That's right. My journey was took me pretty far from Earth. I had the opportunity to explore Pluto.
Wow. How cool is that? How many people get to say that?
You know, not very many.
Not very many.
Feel very, very fortunate.
That's so cool. So you've had a very busy couple of years now, because we met last summer at the NASA Social Conference, which was held in Maryland.
Yes.
At the Applied Physics Laboratory.
Yes.
Which was my first time ever at an Applied Physics Laboratory. And I've got to say, very clean facility. Extraordinarily clean. And then they showed the rooms where you can't have but so many particles in the room to prevent dust from accumulating on new equipment.
Yeah, that's our spacecraft integration rooms, our class 10,000, 100,000 rooms.
I have friends that are very OCD about, you know, wiping the table clean or something, and then I got into that room and I was like, my friends are amateurs. This is amateur hour compared to what's happening at JPL. At Applied Physics. So let me ask you a question. What was it that initially got you interested in science? Maybe not astronomy necessarily, or was it astronomy that initially just...
Well, the very first thing that got me interested was the space program. In the 1960s, remember, they had the Apollo and Gemini programs, and those astronauts and those launches were in the media, on the news all the time. And so as a kid growing up, that's what I saw, and that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. It seemed so exciting and something that I could just latch on to and just enjoy.
Of course, of course. Now, this is when you were in Richmond, right?
Yes, this was when I was 3 or 4 years old. I first started being interested.
That's so cool, because I think a lot of younger memories that I have, certainly, and a lot of my peers have, we think of these ambitious things like, I want to explore the Amazon, I want to be an astronaut, I want to, and then, you know, as we grow up, we kind of do the thing where we get into sports, music, literature, all
right,
these other things, and then we kind of find these other places, but you stuck with the space stuff.
I did. I also did all those other things, but space exploration was one of those career fields that just enthralled me. I wanted a career that was exciting, one that I thought I wouldn't get bored with,
Have you been correct on that presumption?
Well, you know, any career has its slow moments.
There's always paperwork.
There is. There's a lot of tedious work, obviously, that goes into, you know, flying a spacecraft to Pluto. And with us, we had a very, very small team, and so we had a lot of work. So I remember when we launched in 2006, people would ask us, well, what are you going to do between 2006 and 2015? Aren't you going to be bored? And, you know, we kept waiting to be bored. And I can tell you, never for a minute were we bored. We were busy, and we still continue to be extremely busy.
What happens in the interim between the launch and the arrival? From 2006 to 2015, you had to navigate a spacecraft, right, from Cape Canaveral, I think?
Yes,
right?
We launched on the Atlas V from the Cape.
Yeah, from Florida to Pluto.
Yes.
So what happens in those years where
there's
it's in
a lot,
transit?
There's a lot that goes on. First, we have the preparations for launch. So we do a lot of testing with the spacecraft on the ground. We even had built an encounter load. It was very rudimentary, but just to check out all the systems on the ground and also in the software on board the spacecraft to make sure that those main things that we needed to have the spacecraft do actually worked, and because it's much easier to fix things on the ground than it is in space.
You don't say.
Yes, now we can fix things in space, but it takes a lot longer, and it's a little bit more nerve-wracking. And then we launch the spacecraft, and it goes through a commissioning phase. And for this spacecraft, we had the first 3 months were devoted to commissioning the subsystems on the spacecraft. And by that, I mean the guidance and control system, the main computer, the RF system, things like that. And then in the summer after launch, about 6 months after launch, we started the commissioning of the instruments. Now, the instruments were built so that their lighting conditions were to match that on Pluto. So we had to wait until we were farther away from the sun before we could actually commission those instruments.
Oh, wow.
So, and then just, you know, after that was done, we actually had no rest because we were preparing for Jupiter. And Jupiter, we had closest approach with Jupiter February 28, 2007. And what Jupiter allowed us to do was to further test out those instruments and also primarily use Jupiter as a gravity assist, which would shorten our transit time by about 3 years. So we started preparing for Jupiter probably November, December 2006.
Now, a gravity assist, for those that may not be familiar with it, you mean you're using the gravity of Jupiter to help accelerate the vehicle, in a, accelerate its trajectory as it goes around Jupiter and kind of slingshots away towards
yes,
Pluto?
Exactly.
Right. That's, I mean, I was about to say that's heavy, but I realized that that was too pun laden, even for me. But wow, what a crazy thought. So when that was happening, were you just filled with excitement to know that there is a thing that you were a part of that is careening around the largest planet in the solar system?
Yeah, it was pretty spectacular. And we did have a communication outage. So again, we were waiting for that signal return after we'd passed that closest point to Jupiter, just to make sure that the spacecraft, you know, had survived and everything was okay.
And what is the relay time between here and Jupiter for a signal to make it here? It takes hours, right?
The round trip time, which is the time from when it goes from Earth to Jupiter or to the spacecraft at Jupiter and then back to Earth where we get the acknowledgement, is not about 90 minutes. So one way would be about 45 minutes.
Gotcha. And then from Pluto, it's obviously further, right?
Yes. Pluto is at 32 astronomical units, or AU, and the round-trip light time is a little less than 9 hours at closest approach.
Wow. That is just amazing. I love that. That's so cool. That's so cool. Well, okay, so before we get too deep into that stuff, so you did all of your dreaming and desiring to work with the space program here in Richmond,
yes,
right, during the space race, but then so eventually you went to college. You did, you pursued all the other steps necessary to get you to where you are. What all is involved in getting from wishing you were involved with the space program to this moment right here?
Right. So, you know, when you're a kid, you dream big dreams. And you don't have any limits on those dreams because nobody has ever told you that you can't do
right.
something. So holding on to that, you know, making sure that you don't place those limitations on yourself. And that's what I sort of did. When I went to college, I had the goal of studying astrophysics. Well, you know, when you go to college, lots of times you change your mind. And that did happen to me. I had decided after taking an astronomy class that while this was really, really cool, I really wanted to understand more of a broad aspect of science. So I switched my major to physics. And that was really cool because then I got to learn about quantum mechanics and Einstein's theory of relativity, just all these really neat concepts that as a kid and even now, it just blows my mind. And while I was taking those physics classes, I was also interested in chemistry. So I was taking these chemistry classes. And about my third year in college, I realized that if I took a few more classes, I could get a major in chemistry as well. And so that's what I did. I think I was just really just was you know, just enthralled with science unto itself.
That's so great. The love affair begins, right?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So then from there, how does it translate to astronomy and your work with the Applied Physics Laboratory, NASA, and New Horizons?
Well, it was a little bit of a different kind of journey. My first job after graduating from the University of Virginia was for Caltech out in California, and I did research on encapsulating drugs in these little things called micelles. So it was a drug delivery system. So that was a lot of chemistry and physics. From there, I worked for a computer modeling company, again, still in California. And so I used those programming skills, and we were studying soil deformation. So that was a lot of physics again. And then I was able to get a job closer to space, developing infrared detectors. So these are the types of detectors that you use to study infrared, stars in the infrared, things that emit in that wavelength. And so that's sort of was the entry point, because I had a lot of background in those detectors and how you would use those to detect, you know, stellar things. So from there, I got involved into space.
Cool. Remarkable. And then so this mission, I know it launched in 2006, but it had to have been in the works for several years before that,
yeah.
Right?
Interesting enough, our principal investigator, or PI, Alan Stern, in 1989, he formed a group called the Pluto Underground, and they were a group of scientists whose mission, unofficial mission, was to get NASA to fund a mission to Pluto, because it was really the last unexplored planet. So they you know, worked various proposals. They even had one that was funded, but later on NASA had to drop it because the costs started to escalate. And in 2001, we Applied Physics Laboratory partnered with Southwest Research, which is where Alan Stern works, and developed a proposal. And in 2002, it was accepted by NASA. So while you might, New Horizons really started in 2002, being funded by NASA. But really, if you look back, this was a mission that really captured the heart of many scientists earlier than that.
Of course. And it was... Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was launched before Pluto was demoted from its planetary status, right?
Yes. When we launched January 19th, 2006, Pluto was a planet, and it had three moons, Charon, Nix, and Hydra. And so, 8 months after launch, in August of 2006, the IAC redefined the word planet, and Pluto then no longer fit that classification, and it was reclassified to a dwarf planet.
Causing all kinds of drama, right?
It did.
That lasts to this day.
Yes.
It blows my mind that even as this mind-blowing mission is being accomplished, right, you have a few people working at your office, at your lab, which I had the honor of going to go see in person. And I'm seeing the hard work that everyone's doing, and I tell everyone, "Oh, I got to meet the people that are doing the New Horizons thing. We're gonna know things about Pluto." And almost everyone's response was, "Too bad it's not a planet." You know, so it's like, when do we move past that? When do we celebrate the fact that it's a dwarf? It's a whole new thing. Hey,
yeah.
Let's learn about this giant thing. I bet that was probably super exciting for you, though, to have something leave the Earth under the pretense of visiting a planet, and then quickly getting that memo saying, like, FYI.
Right. Well, initially...
Your mission's still on. We've just changed a few words.
It is. I got questions like, well, are you going to, you know, turn the spacecraft around and come back? Are you going to visit someplace else? You know, and Pluto, whether or not it's a planet, is a very interesting place. And even before we knew how interesting it was, it was a place that we'd never gone before. It's a part of the Kuiper Belt objects. It's the king of the Kuiper Belt. It was the closest Kuiper Belt object that we have. So, you know, for its total scientific value, and also as humans, you know, we like to explore. And, you know, it's definitely a worthy target.
I'm just thrilled that everything worked. And, you know, there were no, I mean, I'm sure there were probably many issues that happened throughout the campaign, right, from start to finish.
Yes, yes.
What were some of the highs and lows of, you know, everything that happened with New Horizons?
Well, let's see. Of course, the highs were Jupiter.
Right.
Well, launch first, right. And then and with launch, we got a nearly perfect insertion into our trajectory, which was wonderful because we have a limited amount of propellant on board the spacecraft, and so the less that we have to use to correct our path or trajectory, the more we get to save to do either observations or go on to another object. So that was the first big success. And then, of course, Jupiter. You'll see some pictures of Jupiter. We were able to capture a volcano erupting on Io, which is just spectacular. And to this date, it's the most awesome ex-Earth volcano ever captured by a spacecraft. So
I like that the descriptive is awesome, because that is what it is.
It is. It's awesome.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It is.
Cool. So those are some highs. And of course, getting to Pluto and having the data come back, I'm sure was just...
Oh, wow. Talk about awesome.
Yeah. How was that?
That was like totally amazing. I mean, we knew it was going to be interesting because you could see on that kind of blotchy Hubble image, you could see there was a lot of light and dark
places. Features. There are a lot of things going on. Yeah, sure.
And so we knew it was going to be interesting, but man, when those photos started coming back, it was mind-blowing, even to us working on the program and part of the mission. I mean, Pluto, talk about an interesting place. I mean, it has a little bit of everything. It has water ice mountains that are coated with this methane frost that slides down into these plains and makes these beautiful plains and reflective areas. There's craters. There's even what they think is ice volcanoes. We have different colors on Pluto. We have kind of a reddish color and a yellowish color. Just a lot of diversity going on that planet.
You know, Alice, if this science thing doesn't work out for you, I think you're totally set to work for any board of tourism. This place has got it all. That's so cool. So what are some things that, when the information came back, were there any things that you felt like you were going to see that you didn't, or that you weren't expecting? Like, was there something that just totally caught you off guard?
For me, I was just open to seeing anything. I don't think I have had a lot of preconceived notions. You know, you've seen pictures of Mars and Mercury, and so the thought is you'd probably see something similar to that. So it was totally amazing when we saw that and much, much more. I think that for me, the most spectacular picture that has been returned is the one with the atmosphere. So you can see those layers of atmosphere. That is amazing.
Absolutely. So we played that in the dome at the Science Museum, right? So, and I thought, like, well, is this like a weird shot of the Earth from something that I haven't seen yet? But it turns out that Pluto also has a bluish haze to it.
It does. Has a bluish haze, and it has all those levels of atmosphere that you can see in that picture. It has some complex chemical breakdowns and combinations going on. It is just a really, really cool place.
So when I met you last summer, the one thing that you said that blew my mind about this project was the fact that New Horizons was literally going to fly by, and then it's done, right?
Right.
So it launches in 2006. You're doing all kinds of work to make sure that it gets to Pluto. You have to go around Jupiter. You have to probably do lots of communication troubleshooting and constant surveillance on what's happening, what's not. And then when you finally get to the target, how many hours did you actually have in the Pluto system comfortably?
Well, it depends on when you start measuring the Pluto system, but the most intense operations were in a 22-hour period.
That's it, 22 hours. 2006 to 2015 for a 22-hour approach. That's so remarkable. And you got so much information.
We did. You have to understand that all of our command sequences or commands were put together by hand. We didn't have any special software that looked for the most opportune places on how to do it, like some of the other spacecraft that are orbiters, because we felt that we had a number of years to work on this encounter sequence, which actually we started working on it in 2008, 2010. And so we honed all that in, those command sets, into, you know, what we thought was the perfect dance between observing the different moons and the planets and communicating with Earth. And, you know, so when you work with, you know, those ones and zeros, those bits like that, you feel that personal connection. And so when everything worked perfect, the whole team was just, I mean, you know, besides being extremely happy that we made success, it was like, you know, our baby had done what we taught it to do.
Of course. Gosh, that's so cool. That's so awesome. Now, once that information has all been processed, or captured rather, it gets sent to Earth bit by bit, right? So we're still getting information.
Yes.
And we will presumably still be getting information for a few months, maybe even further than that?
Right. We expect to have the information down, all the data down from the encounter, just that period in July, by November-ish 2016.
Okay, so we still have several months ahead of us.
We do.
Where we will still be receiving new information.
Yes.
So there are still things about Pluto that even you don't know yet.
Exactly. And so you can go to the website, and every couple days you can see something new posted.
That's awesome. So the New Horizons now is past Pluto. And do we have enough fuel to go visit another Kuiper Belt object?
Well, actually, we got approval from NASA to burn our engines to put the spacecraft on a trajectory to our next object, our next encounter object, which is 2014 MU69. Very glamorous name. We hope that we can rename that.
Yeah.
And the reason why we did the burns in the fall, last fall, was because we can use less propellant if we do them early. Now we are currently working on the proposal for the extended mission, which means that we're asking for funding to actually collect science when we go by this object. And that proposal gets submitted in April. I think it was April 15th, and hopefully we'll hear in June whether or not NASA will fund the extended mission.
Are you allowed to say what you're trying to look for at this Kuiper Belt object? What kind of observations are you trying to make?
I am, but I can tell you that we haven't really started that planning. We've started just the initial scope out so that we can write that proposal.
Gotcha.
So the idea is that we've been talking, or the scientists have been talking about flying as close to as 2,000 kilometers to the object.
Wow.
And as far away as 10,000 kilometers. Of course, this is an object that we don't know a lot about, and
sure.
So we need to use a lot of assets to figure out if there's anything in the way, or, you know, how close can we really get?
So you've touched on two things that I really want to talk about. So things getting in the way. So you were making sure that New Horizons had a safe trajectory, a safe path all the way from Florida to Pluto, right? Now,
yes.
Driving here from my house this morning, I encountered probably 15 hazardous situations. I presume that
right.
New Horizons probably had many opportunities to have something happen to it, but you probably had to... You and your team probably had to figure out ways to avoid things, or...
Yes. As for hazards, space is mostly empty, and the chances of encountering a hazard that you don't know about, a small moon or a piece of rock, increase when you get closer to the Pluto system. So we were constantly looking, or having our instruments look along our spacecraft path to see if we saw anything that we didn't expect. And thank goodness we didn't see anything, our hazard team didn't see anything, and we were able to load up the best science observation sequence that we could. Now, if we had seen something in our way, we did have an alternate sequence prepared, and what that sequence would have done is taken the antenna dish, which is the largest part of the spacecraft, and used that like a shield and moved across those 4 hours where we thought was the most chance of encountering something, but we did not. But as for anomalies on board the spacecraft, we have encountered, I think, on the order of 14, and they range from the main processor resetting to the one on July 4th, which was a bus controller swap.
Okay.
So we, starting in, I think our first one was in 2007, so we had worked together as a team to recover the spacecraft from various anomalies since 2007. We had a process in place, and each anomaly that we encountered, so that's a word that maybe people aren't going
to ask. I was going to say, like, what is an anomaly on board the New Horizons?
An anomaly is something abnormal, and when I went and visited my friend Sarah, she said, Alice, anomaly, you know, that's a cool engineering term, but isn't that really Houston, we have a problem?
Yeah, right.
And I said, yes, Sarah, that's right.
Great.
So maybe that's a better way to...
so what were some of... So you're saying that on board there were issues that basically when they happened here, we would have to beam something up saying, like, no, do this instead.
Yes. So the spacecraft has a very robust autonomy system on board. And what that is, it's a software that's monitoring the spacecraft for various fault conditions and will react to those conditions depending on what they are. So when we are in just normal operations, the basic response of the autonomy system will be to put the spacecraft into what we call safe mode. And when the spacecraft goes into that mode, it can't take any pictures.
Right.
It is at its lowest communication rate at 10 bits per second. And it spins at 5 RPM because it's a spin-stabilized spacecraft, and it's a very safe state for the spacecraft. And then the autonomy system will wait for instructions from the ground.
Wow. Wow. I'm trying to process all of this to think of, you know, what would I do if one day someone came up to me and said, hey, there's this thing that you're in charge of, and it's about a billion miles from you right now. There's no way you're going to be able to touch it, but it's blinking funny. You know,
right.
It's like, that's amazing. Now, okay, so it's going to hopefully it's going to not have any issues with bumping into these smaller moons or rocks.
Right.
And it'll
right.
go explore the Kuiper Belt object. Hopefully the funding passes.
Right.
But Alice Bowman, I have a question for you. What happens after that? I mean, this thing is going to just keep going, right?
It will. I think everybody's familiar with the Voyager spacecraft.
Absolutely.
And that's our goal, really, is to be looked at as kind of a Voyager kind of mission. We hope that we will get funded for another extended mission and go on to collect plasma data that's in the far reaches of our solar system. We have a radio isotope thermoelectric generator on board the spacecraft.
Who doesn't?
RTG. It's a nuclear-powered spacecraft because the sun cannot provide enough energy when you're out that far. So that radio thermoelectric isotope will decay as time passes.
Is that plutonium?
Yes, it's plutonium-238.
Okay.
And in mid-2030s, we think that we will not have enough power to turn on our transmitter on board the spacecraft. And so we believe that the spacecraft can continue to return viable science data up until that point.
Yeah, wow. And then the hope is, Voyagers are a great example,
oh,
right?
Oh boy, they're great.
Because the idea for them, I believe, in the grand scheme of the Carl Sagan type of thinking, is that the Voyagers will eventually end up in somebody's hands.
Yes.
At some point.
Yes.
Way out there.
Yes.
Do you feel like, does your team have a similar hope for New Horizons? Does Alice Bowman have that? Like, I mean, do you hope that this thing ends up at some point, long after, you know, the mission has ended and long after the plutonium has been used up? Do you hope that one day something will find it and be like, what's this?
I do. You know, it's it's part of our exploring nature. I think that, you know, it would be really neat. There are a couple things on that spacecraft that would be interesting to for someone to find.
My favorite thing that I read about the spacecraft are the ashes of Mr. Tombaugh.
Yes.
The discoverer of Pluto. How romantic is that?
It is. It's pretty romantic. And his children were actually there with us when we had closest approach and communicating with the spacecraft.
What was that like, talking to the kids?
Well, that was really cool.
They're obviously not kids anymore, right?
Right. That was pretty neat to hear the stories that they told about their dad dragging them out of bed in the middle of the night to look at the stars through his handmade telescope. It sort of goes to prove that when you have a dream and you really want to do something, that, you know, no matter where you are, he was a farm boy in Kansas, that you can really make those dreams come true.
That's such a wonderful statement, and you're proof of that as well. I mean, you were sitting here in Richmond, Virginia, where you are right now, looking at the space race, thinking,
yes,
I got to get in on this. And
yes,
here you are. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for all your time, and thanks for talking about all of this stuff. This is really inspiring. It's wonderful. Is there a final message that you would like to put out into the universe here about, you know, about anything that you do or anything that you hope people get into pertinent to what you're doing?
I think it's just keep those child dreams. And, you know, whether you follow a career that's part of that dream, or you read books and follow it, you know, how the experience is going for somebody else, I think that's something that we all need to do. It gives us faith in humanity and purpose to our life.
You're such a fun person to talk. I could not possibly think of a better thing to close out this interview with. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much, Alice.
Thank you.